This podcast is proudly sponsored by Aspire Autism Consultancy, the leading providers of autism and ADHD training, educating and enabling families, therapists and healthcare professionals to gain knowledge and understanding of neurodiversity. The courses are written by two specialist psychotherapists and include the voices and lived experiences of neurodivergent individuals. For further details, go to www.aspireautismconsultancy.co.uk. Hi everyone, I'm John Offord, I'm a broadcaster based in the UK, and welcome to Different Minds, a podcast series that looks at neurodiversity, the different ways our brains can work and interpret information. I'm delighted to be joined by Adam Frost, a British gardener, designer, known for his successes at the Chelsea Flower Show, and of course as a presenter on the BBC's Gardeners World programme. I'm going to talk about dyslexia today. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hello mate, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, good. Surviving.
Surviving, indeed, surviving. That's the main thing, isn't it? So here we are, almost midway through 2021. How has life been for you in lockdown?
Like everybody, really. It's had its challenges. But also, on the flip side of it, I think it's the first time, probably from being 16 years old, I've had the time to stop and think and work out if what I'm doing is the right thing or the wrong thing. And, you know, the kids have struggled. Mrs. Frost has struggled. So it's like everybody, you know, I suppose a lot of people look at my life from the outside and maybe think it's full of joy. But actually, this last sort of 12 months plus has, you know, brought its challenges.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, Adam, I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about how you actually got into gardening in the first place.
If I go right back. It was grandparents. I had quite a difficult childhood, so I spent a lot of time with grandparents, and I had the two sets. So if I break them up into, I had Scruffy Nan and I had Tidy Nan. Scruffy Nan had this sort of, well, actually her and my grandpa had quite high flying jobs. He was a gun engineer and she worked in Whitehall, but they had this slightly sort of bohemian existence at the weekends. They had this sort of overgrown garden outside of London, which I used to explore. And Nan, I don't know, she taught me how to grow coleus and cactus. She had two big old greenhouses. So I had that as an experience and slightly sort of, there was a freedom with that. And then I had Tidy Nan, and Tidy Nan was a little bit more controlling. So they lived in a co-op, you know, social housing sort of thing. They had an allotment down the end, but Nan had, she was that controlling. She'd tie up her brambles, you know, she was sort of that sort of lady, but she was a gem. But my granddad had the allotment and he grew everything. I suppose those early memories, really, when I first started gardening, and actually it's only as life evolved, I got moved from, well, I went to school in Harlow. I got moved from there to Devon when I was 15 years old, which was a disaster, I'll be honest with you.
Right.
As much as Devon's a beautiful place, I don't know, I rocked up down there and it was like going back in time. And I sort of disengaged from school, and then 16 years old, I woke up one day and my mum and dad had moved down as well by then, and they were then doing a swap with another couple. So I woke up one day and a bloke that was going to become my stepdad had been married to the woman that was going to become my stepmum. So 16 and a half, I moved out home, got a flat and got a job on a parks department, and that's where the professional life started. So yeah, that's a really a fast forward view, you know, of the first bit, really.
And now you are a presenter on the BBC's flagship Gardeners World programme. So how did that come about?
It was never part of a plan. Me on telly was never part of the plan. I think it's quite interesting because people obviously watch me, and people that have known me for years will go, Frosty, how have you ended up doing that? Because I love my sport and I loved, you know, using my hands and creating. And but outside of that, I was a lad that was quite happy to sit quietly in a corner in a pub and have a couple of pints. And I think it just evolved. over time, and, you know, going to shows, doing the odd interview, and different people saying to me, you know, you should do that, you'd be quite good at this. And I think originally, I think I was probably pushed rather than as much by Mrs. Frost as anyone else. You know, and it just sort of evolved and happened. And then, you know, then you end up on Gardener's World, so, which is a bit bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah. So how has life changed for you then since you've been on the telly?
It's, again, I'll go back to the lad that liked the quiet pint. You know, I was known, I suppose, locally because I'd gone to Chelsea and I'd done pretty well. So, you know, I was known in the town that I live in. And always people would want to talk about gardening. And it was like that went on to a completely different level. I knew Gardener's World was a big gig. I didn't realise it was that big. You know, when you're sort of walking along Oxford Street and some cabbie's shouting out the window, Frosty, blah, 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 you know, and you're in an airport and you realise actually Gardener's World goes to America, it goes to different places in Europe. And it puts you, I suppose, really in the public eye. But other parts of life, I'm still a gardener. So it's, you know, it's strange.
Yeah, and going back to what we first started talking about in terms of like lockdown and obviously the pandemic that we all find ourselves in, I guess a lot of people are spending more time at home and perhaps now the weather's getting warmer in their gardens. Is gardening good for you, Adam?
On every single level, mate. I think the first lockdown, you know, if we go back now more than 12 months ago, I think one of the reasons wasn't just because it was the first one that we all seemed to cope with it a little bit better. I think it was because the weather was good and we could still get outside and we could get into green spaces a lot of the time, whether that was, a garden, a park, the wider landscape. I think that played its part. And I think by the end, you know, the next one that came in the winter, people were finding that a lot more difficult to do. And so I think that that's played its part. I mean, you know, everything from having your hands in the soil to having a few moments in a green space, it's been proven now physically, mentally, there's been so much research done that, and if I've got one, I suppose, hope, probably heart driven more than brain driven, is that actually so many of us will look at that simpler side of life, and reconnect and want more from their gardens and from their landscape now, you know. So, yeah, definitely good for you.
So do you think there'll be a resurgence then in kind of gardening, I guess?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I look at it on a, you know, on the media point of view. If you went back 18 months ago and came up with an idea for a television program for a gardening, this, that and the other, you know, most of telly would have told you, no, there's too much of that and there's too much gardening. But actually, in reality now, we're having lots of phone calls, you know, from either channels or from production companies that are looking as gardening now being back on, you know, as the main course and being out there for people to enjoy. And so if you look at it that way, but then also, you know, the stuff that I do, I don't know, sort of, you know, government stuff with the Royal Horticultural Society, and you read figures coming out that apparently, you know, we've got 3 million new gardeners, you know. And so I think that there's got to be I suppose what I'm saying is that I know on a personal level that actually the moment I put my hands in the soil, the moment I, you know, I did a nice pot, I built something, I did, it made things a little bit better. And I think there was a lot of people that maybe have never tried that in their life for various reasons. Yeah. And it would have got a lot of people. It would have got to a lot of people.
Yeah. So Adam, this podcast, as you know, looks at neurodiversity. So essentially the different ways our brains work and interpret information, and it essentially is about celebrating our differences and understanding that we all see the world differently. You have dyslexia. I wonder if you could tell us A, what that is, and your journey, you know, when you were diagnosed and how that made you feel, etc.
If you go back to being at school, I mean, you know, I'm now 50 odd, so being at school, dyslexia wasn't really talked about, and, you know, so you were the fit kid, really. And to be fair, that's one of the reasons I went into gardening, because gardening, and it's still at times now, it's talked about in, well, you know, if you're not very academic, maybe you could be a gardener, or you could be a chef, or, you know, maybe join the army. That was my offer when I left school, really. Right. But actually, you, even as a kid, I knew I wasn't daft.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like I had some sort of social intelligence. I could communicate, and, you know, I was comfortable in around my friends and this, that, and the other. And, but when it came to reading, I really struggled. Things were all over the shop. Even now, if I read 3 or 4 pages of a book, I'll either have to read it about 8 times or I'll be asleep, you know. And, but so as a kid, it strips away everything, you know, you sort of your confidence. And the only way that you realize, I suppose, is you duck and dive, you know. So you learn to sit next to the brightest kid in the class, and you learn to cheat a little bit, and, you know, and you find a way, don't you? You know, and, yeah. And I went through school like that, even my teenage years. So I was probably early to mid 20s, and I had a mate that was away at university, and he didn't know that. So I didn't even know then. People had said to me, and it had been talked about a lot more, you're probably dyslexic. And he was tested at university, right. And he had all the paperwork and bits and pieces from his test. And him and I sat and did it. Right. And I was just as dyslexic as he was.
Right.
And at that point, I don't know what I felt, really. I probably felt slightly relieved,
yeah,
that there was something that I, you know, there was a reason why I couldn't maybe perceive, you know, the written language like other people could. But I think it was more or less, I reckon I was mid to late 20s before I read an article in an American architectural magazine, and it was about dyslexia. And this article more or less said, bear in mind, this is a long time ago now, mate. Yeah. This article more or less said that if you were dyslexic in the creatives, you know, so if you were going to be an architect or, you know, design world or whatever, actually, it would probably make a lot of sense to put that on your CV.
Wow.
And that sat me on my backside.
Yeah.
And then I probably started to ask a lot more questions, because one thing I can do is I can organize space in my head. Well, when you're the thick person, you just imagine everybody else can do that, you know, and it's only as you start talking to people, and I suppose, and you build confidence, that you realize exactly what you said is we all see the world in a slightly different way. And yeah, it's just becoming comfortable with the way that you see the world, you know, and I think, actually, looking back now, being dyslexic was probably a blessing. Which sounds cracker, doesn't it?
It's really interesting what you say there, because essentially, you know, neurodiversity is valuable to employers, because, you know, obviously, as you implied there, you know, neurodivergent, you know, individuals bring unique skills and strengths over and above, you know, what we would call the neurotypical in that sense. And you know, there are so many strengths to neurological conditions, and I think we're coming to a place now where we can recognise that and celebrate that. You know, often the language that we use can be so negative, and actually, yeah, like you just said there, it's about the strengths, isn't it, that come with that?
Yeah, and I definitely think so, because I think as well, when you're sort of, you know, the youngsters now are brought up, I suppose, in a different world to what we were brought up in, but that, I don't know, we've got an in my head, we've got an education system that in a lot of ways, if you don't sit between two tram lines, you know, you more or less are outside of society before you even start, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I don't know, the fact that we lost so many technical colleges and we lost that side of society, for me we've lost so many valuable assets to society through doing that. Because, yeah, I think, you know, being able to use your hands, being able to think differently, see the world slightly in a different way. And yeah. I suppose, again, it's only as I've got older and the more people I've spoken to, this realization that maybe you do see the world in a slightly different way to other people. But
yeah, it's fascinating. You know, I've interviewed the likes of Chris Packham and Temple Grandin, and they talk about the strengths that come with autism, for example. And as you just said, of the ability to see things in a completely different way, and you know that plays a strength to, you know, particular industries, and you know that, and it is about focusing on those strengths, and so definitely can relate to what you've just said there. Yeah, I just want to go back to when you said about, you know, when you were almost sometimes felt like they're the thick kid in school, and I guess there's still sometimes, you know, people want to keep quiet about their dyslexia or any neurological condition for fear of being judged by society. And I guess there are still misconceptions out there, and people think, well, you know, I'll just keep that quiet because I don't want people to think I'm thick. What would you say to people listening that might be not sure whether they, you know, that they want to get a diagnosis or not, or whether, you know, maybe they feel ashamed of that?
I would say, I suppose, in that sense, I mean, I suppose I've been there and got the T-shirt. I'm quite happy now. I would quite happy now. You know, we're having this conversation. Yeah. I'm quite happy wherever this goes, you know, and I suppose I've employed enough people. I've been around enough people that, you know, various different neurological sort of things going on. I've got a girl called Polly, who's, she's now going to be petrified of what I'm going to say. She sat opposite me in the office. Polly's dyslexic.
Yeah.
Polly creative wise is coming on like leaps and bounds. And yeah. Interestingly enough, what you can see with her is actually probably confidence wise where she was when she came into the office compared to now is mind blowing. And I think that so much of that has been built out of being able to be creative. And yeah. And I think that what I would say to people is whatever it is that you're connecting to that you love, use that to build the confidence, but also never ever be ashamed of feeling slightly outside the room or slightly different, because ultimately that's what makes society, really, you know. And I think you're right in what you said. We should celebrate it. We should not, you know, and we should not look down our noses at people that maybe, you know, are perceived as different. Because I'm not even sure if there's something, you know, they use the word normal.
Yeah.
What's normal?
Yeah.
You know, apart from a load of old nonsense. Yeah. You know, and so I think that we can all play our part in society. And I think what I did learn is that I would work hard.
Yeah.
And actually probably what I ended up doing because of it is it probably gave me resilience. I probably worked harder than I would have done if I'd have gone through a normal academic route. And I don't know, maybe that's what's got me to where I don't think necessarily I'm the most talented at anything I do, but I know that I will get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning if I need to do it, and I'll carry on doing it until 4 o'clock the following morning if I need to do it. And I think that's the bit that people need to tap into is our own sort of our own drive.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think enough's been done in schools to raise awareness and support people with dyslexia?
I think it's a lot better than it was. And that's sort of the experience of my own kids. One of them, number three. So my sort of third, number two girl, yeah. She's a slow processor. She's a bright kid, you know, but sometimes it just takes her a little bit longer to process information. But you can see that's knocked her confidence at times, and she's been in quite an academic world, and she's just about to leave that. And I can see her flying because of it, but that was picked up, you know. So I do think they pick up dyslexia. And even if you look at things like, you know, ADHD and things like that now, and they're finding that in kids, and we're slowly starting to understand that, you know, that brings things to the party. That's not all negative. It's just about learning how to live with that and learning how to sort of get the best out of it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the key to all this is not looking at it in a negative way. It's looking at all the positives and then teaching people how to get the best out of themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Adam, what do you think needs to be done in terms of like the media representation of neurological conditions like dyslexia? Do you think the media have it right?
Not always. No. You know, I've been sat in meetings, especially early telly, and I could actually quote three or four different production companies and dyslexia coming up during conversation and sitting there at the time quite quietly because it was talked about in a negative way. But then flip that on its head, I think there's an awful lot of people that are talk about it in a positive. I think that ultimately what needs to happen is it needs to be a general acceptance across the board. Yeah. So I would say there's a lot of positives, but I would say there's still a fair amount of negatives in, you know, we still got an education system that, yeah, I don't think necessarily suits, you know, you've spoken to the people you've spoken to, and this probably gets repeated. They probably didn't necessarily feel like they fitted in, yeah, at school.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So maybe that's what we need to relook at, our education system, find out, you know, whatever it is, you know, we need to understand more about our kids' early doors. And when we do, we need to have the right provisions across the board from whatever class, you know, whatever walk of life you come from, you should be given the same opportunity. And I don't know, I've got dyslexic mates and what they can do with their hands is mind blowing. And, you know, the most academic people in the world that I've met, you know, I've met people that can change a light bulb, you know, and you've got that difference. But the people that are the most academic in the world are looked upon as being up there and at it. Whereas, you know, if you use your hands, maybe, you know, you're not quite so comfortable in society. But I don't know. I don't know if that answers it or not,
yeah,
mate.
No, it does, yeah. Adam, no. So you already touched on this, so how does having dyslexia help with gardening?
I think in a lot of ways, I think there's I've got a visual awareness that I now know that I've got. I seem to be able to, you see, I'll give you a prime example. Mm-hmm. When like, say I'm filming at the Chelsea Flower Show.
Yep.
So it will say, Adam to ad lib for 3 minutes.
Yeah,
that's what it will say. All right. So there's no script. There's no this. I've got to go on. I've got to look at a space. I've got to work out what's good about it, what's bad about it, how it works on all sorts of different levels. And then I've got to tell you that happens in my head.
Yeah.
And when I talk to other people about it that have not got dyslexia or this, that and the other, go, well, hold on. Whoa. What do you mean that happens in your head? I said, well, I look at it and I'm sort of working out layers and levels. I'm working out how you move through the space. You know, there's a color thing that goes on. There's, you know, there's textures, there's forms, there's shapes, there's all this stuff. And in my little head, that either feels comfortable or if it doesn't feel comfortable. And if it doesn't feel comfortable, I can then probably work out what I think would probably be changed to make the space a little bit better. And I suppose that is a lot of what I do in the office. I look at a blank piece of paper and then I create. And I think what I've learned to do is learn to listen. So I listen a lot to people when, you know, clients talking. I use a lot of sort of visual driven stuff as well. And that's how I sort of take information out of people. And even, you know, with books and things like that, I do it all audio. You know, so I've, yeah, you know, I'm running, I've got an audio book on, I'm in the car, it's music or an audio book. And
you're probably listening to the Different Minds podcast series, aren't you, if you're running?
I am, mate. I am, definitely.
So Adam, you, if I look at the NHS website in the UK, it says dyslexia is a common learning difficulty that can cause problems with reading, writing and spelling. And you just mentioned, you know, books there, and I know you've published your own books. Just tell us how that came about.
Yeah, could you imagine that first conversation, Adam? We want you to do a book. And to be fair, my missus and kids think it's hilarious. So my oldest daughter works in the office and she has to work out. I think she's become really good, really. She should probably set up an industry. She has to work out dad's scribbles. And I'm either doing something at 300 miles an hour, but she seems to have learned to fill in the gaps and knows what I'm going to want to say, you know?
Yeah.
But the first thing about doing a book, I think in a sense, I just worked out that in reality, is a book is, it's my thoughts really put on to page. So I did it in a very sort of, I talked, you know, so I talked through everything, every thought process, every thought I wanted to do. And then with the help of, you know, a lovely editor, turn that into a book. But yeah, and actually with things like that, when, you know, I don't know, maybe if it's a poem or maybe if it's a little article, as long as I'm comfortable enough just to write and talk and not worry about what it looks like on a page or work out what I've actually put down at the end of it, then I've sort of built a confidence with that. But I'll be hand on heart, all right? I have to sign books now. This is the scariest bit out of all that. I have to sign books. And people want it personalised. I literally have an internal panic button. And actually, it's quite nice when Mrs. Frost is with me because she'll go, right, if you could just tell me this, and then she'll more or less be saying to me, it's spelled this, 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 this. And it's that, you know, ducking and diving bit, isn't it? Because then what I'll do to a lot of people is, oh, you know, names are all spelled different, aren't they? You know, so if you tell me your name, how you want it spelled, because I don't want to insult you, so you find a way of doing it.
Yeah.
But there's still that panic. That panic was there when I first got a checkbook and I had to go and write, you know, whatever it was, £130 or whatever. Mate, I was shaking.
Yeah.
Literally shaking. And there's still moments of that, but that early ducking and diving probably still comes into play at times.
Absolutely. Really interesting, Adam. Yeah, we're coming towards the end of the podcast now, but I want to ask you a question that I ask all my guests on the Different Minds podcast series. And that is, if you had the opportunity, what advice would you give your younger self?
Wow. I'm going to give exactly the same advice that I give to all my kids, really. I've said to every single one of them, I've not pushed any of them academically. I've said to all of them, the only time you'll ever get in trouble at home is if you come home and that effort bit is lacking, then you're getting bothered. But apart from that, the best thing you can do with your life is find something that you love and then convince somebody to pay you to do it. And that's the bit of advice I give to everybody is try. And I know it's not easy at 16 years old, 18 years old, 20 years old, but keep looking until you find something you love and then work out how you're going to make a living out of it. And I think in reality, that's probably what I've done.
That's amazing. Adam, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you today. I'm going to ask you one more question and put you on the spot. Any top tip, gardening tips for us today?
Yeah, definitely. First thing is just get out, get your hands in the soil, you know, enjoy the season. But the one thing that we probably don't all do enough is put enough work into our soil. I would say more than anything is for everybody to get your soil in good heart, and whether that means adding organic matter, you know, well-rotted manure. I was lucky enough to work for a fellow called Jeff Hamilton many years ago who presented Gardener's World. Jeff was a legend, but he would say to me all the time, boy, because I still, even in my mid-20s, got called boy, the answer's in the soil. And I would, you know, I've carried that mantle, and I would say to anybody, get your soil in good heart and your garden will be okay.
Adam, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you for your time.
Cheers, fella.